Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Tuesday, April 21st, we are studying Genesis chapter 49, verses 1 to 27. In today's text, Jacob calls his sons together and speaks prophetically to them concerning the days to come. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor James Uglum. Pastor Uglum serves at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in St. Peter's, Missouri. Pastor Uglum, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
As we get started today, Pastor, remind us of the context as we prepare to look at Genesis 49 today.
Yeah, so we are coming up quickly on the end of the book of Genesis. And so where we find ourselves in this moment, we've got Israel, his family, they have settled in the land of Goshen in Egypt. Things are still going well for them at this point because we're on the front end of their time in Egypt. And he's going to be, as you mentioned, bringing his 12 sons together to bless them. But in the preceding chapter, he does something a little odd. He calls together Joseph's two sons and Ephraim and Manasseh, and he blesses them as well. And so this is actually what we get today is the second set of blessings. But it's interesting because he blesses Joseph's two sons, but he doesn't bless them as a grandfather blessing grandsons. He says, in essence, your sons are mine. So he's going to reckon them among his own sons. They become, when they enter the promised land, the two of the 12 tribes of Israel, which is one of those things, if you've ever tried as a kid, I remember reading through scriptures and I'd read through, here in Genesis or later on when you're reading through lists of the 12 tribes of Israel and you're trying to piece them all together, you always wind up scratching your head because the lists never seem to quite match up. And we'll see that a little bit today as well. But it's one of the reasons is for this reason. Joseph's allotment is split between his two sons. And then Levi, of course, doesn't get an allotment in the land. And we'll see a little bit of that in the blessings of Levi that we come upon here today. But the other thing with this, I could say in the background and context is in many ways, what we'll talk about here, these blessings of Jacob's sons, it becomes the bridge between the events of Genesis and then prophetically the things that are going to happen in Israel as they enter the promised land, as they receive that rest from God in the land of milk and honey. So we'll see some of that. These verses, they both look backwards at events that had happened in these sons' lives and also looks forward to the things that are set to come.
Right. And much like we said with the previous text, that when Moses writes this down, in the aftermath of the Exodus, it's important for those people who are reading it and learning it for the first time to know these events. The same is true of chapter 49. Of course, both right. Chapter 48 and 49 actually happened and thus are written down. But it serves an important purpose for the people of Israel as they prepare to enter into the promised land to see how the Lord has been faithful, how the Lord spoke prophetically here through Jacob, their forefather. So all of those things are in play here. And as you said, this very much does serve an important purpose in the transition from the end of Genesis into the book of Exodus and beyond in the whole of Moses' writings. So It's a long chapter in the sense that there are a lot of things that you could talk about. Maybe I'll do this someday. I'll make one series out of just this chapter where you dedicate one episode to each of the tribes. Because if you wanted to, you could go down all of those paths with this.
Correct. I mean, there's a lot of little rabbit trails. Obviously, this is written. It's prophetic and also poetic. Right. Which means if you're reading through this and wondering, at least as a first read through it, wondering, I don't, you know, see any of these connections, it's fine. It's definitely one of those things that's meant to be taken slower. And so if you're reading through this, especially without the aid of a commentary, it's helpful to read through each tribe, to pause and say, what have I heard of either this son of Jacob or this tribe? And when you do that, then you begin to see some of the connections that maybe you wouldn't see just at the beginning.
Sure. Yeah. And a text like this, part of the reality we just have to recognize is that we know more about some of the tribes of Israel than we do about others. Much like the 12 right. disciples of Jesus, you know, Peter, James, John, Judas Iscariot, we know a lot about those guys. We know less about Thaddeus. I mean, that's just the reality of it. Similarly right. here, like sometimes what we're going to read perhaps about Asher, that's one of the few things that we know about that tribe as a whole from the scriptures. And that's just part of the reality. And part of the joy of reading the scriptures is putting these things together. So yeah, we're gonna do our best here today to give an overview of what is in this chapter concerning these 12 sons of Jacob. I'm going to start by reading Jacob's opening words, or the introduction that Moses gives, and his opening words then in verse 2 of the chapter. So this is Genesis 49, 1 and 2. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you what shall happen to you in days to come. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father." Right, so those are the opening words before he starts naming any of his sons. Take us into this introduction.
Yeah, so right away with the introduction, when I was watching this and reading through this the first time, you'll notice we've got the headings of each of these chapters that, you know, were added in much later. But as you're reading those, this was one that might cause you to trip up a little bit. You know, it's my heading in the ESV Bible I use says, "Jacob blesses his sons." Okay. So I've got an idea of what's going to come. I understand, you know, if I was going to bless my children, you know, we've lived a, you know, long life together, I'm on my way out, God's going to take me, you know, I can imagine how that would go. But what happens is, very quickly you realize with Reuben, it doesn't really sound like a blessing, what Israel is saying. And so it's blessings, but it's blessings as scripture uses the words, not as we kind of understand them in our everyday language. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other is he says right off the bat in verse 1 that, you know, Moses is telling us that he's going to tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come. And so this is also, it gives us a glimpse that there's more to these blessings than meets the eye. So some of them are going to point us ahead to the things that are going to happen, some in the time of Moses, some, you know, much later than the time of Moses. And so that's a helpful thing to keep in the back of your mind as you're reading through these and hearing these as well.
Yeah, that's right. The word blessing does get used for this section in the verse that immediately follows what we will read today. And so there, you know, it's not a wrong way of titling the chapter, but you're right. When you first see that title in the ESV or other English translations, you're maybe expecting to hear one thing that you don't end up hearing. And that's okay. And we remember with what Isaac did for Esau and to Jacob, how Jacob came and stole the blessing that Esau wanted, and all that was left for Esau was something else, which was a blessing of sorts. And they were prophetic words about what would happen to Esau, but it wasn't exactly, quote, a blessing. We're thinking about those larger prophetic words that Jacob has here for his sons. In terms of kind of just by overarching themes, you know, we're going right. to look at each individual son. What are we going to encounter given what Jacob's said thus far?
Yeah, so one of the overarching themes that you see here, and actually you see in the book of Genesis itself, it's reiterated here, is this idea that, again, with the story that we have in Genesis that Moses is relating to us is that humanity lost God's blessings all the way at the beginning in the Garden of Eden in that rebellion. But there's also this promise that runs through the book of Genesis that God is going to restore those blessings through, and then, you know, as we get further on in this book, through, you know, the seed of, you know, this offspring of Eve, and then, you know, then it gets, you know, zeroed in on Abraham and his family, And we're going to zero in even more today where we'll see the focus on Judah. But this is the idea that God is, we've lost the blessing of God through our own actions, our own rebellion and sin, but God himself is going to restore that blessing in an incredible way through this family.
Yeah, that's right. So I think, you tell me, I was thinking it makes sense to read it one son at a time because I'm afraid we're going to get lost if I read the whole thing at once. And I do, I suppose I envision Jacob, you know, looking sort of one by one at his sons as he does this. I think they all hear everything, but he does seem to direct each section to a particular son. So I was planning to read it one son at a time, so we can kind of zoom in on those. And again, some there's going to be more, some there's going to be less.
Right. I think that's the best way to do it. And recognizing that some there's going to be more, some there's going to be less is also a helpful way to read this passage. Because if you do the simple math, you know, the amount of verses, or you could count the words that Israel uses for his sons, what's going to stand out for you is, especially when you just do the verse count, Judah and Joseph are going to receive the most words from their father, five verses apiece. And that also then is one of the symbolic things that you'll see come through, in that it's Judah and Joseph, you know, they become emblematic of both the northern and southern tribes of Israel. And so, yeah, I think reading it son by son is probably the best way to go. And some sons, there's going to be more to talk about than others.
All right, good. And just one more thing in terms of the order here. Generally, they seem to be, it seems like they're organized by their mother more than by their age in terms of the order.
Yeah, so one of the things you'll notice, we get down to, which son is it? I believe it's...
Yeah.
So the way this lists, if you were to look at the birth order of the sons, there's some back and forth between Leah, Bilhah, Zilpha, and then Rachel's two sons at the end. But what Jacob does is he blesses all the sons of Leah first, then he mixes up the sons of Bilhah and Zilpha a bit, and then he ends with Joseph and Benjamin. And so he does mix the order up a little bit as he's blessing his sons. But this is what Jacob does. I mean, if you look at his blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh, it's another incredible thing. One of the things that stands out in the blessings of these sons as well, you know, he goes to bless both sons and he crosses his hands and he blesses the second first and the first second. And of course, Joseph says, no, Dad, this is the oldest. He said, this is how it's going to be. And that's how it was in Jacob's life with his own brother Esau as well. And that's just how he's going to do it. But it's also a reminder that in God's kingdom, as in the kingdom of Israel, sometimes the first are last and the last are first. And so you get a flavor of that here, even in Genesis.
And I do think, just again, by an overarching comment, as you noted, in various lists of the sons of Israel in the scriptures, there are different orders, and sometimes you know, one gets even left out occasionally, or gets, you know, with this matter of Joseph's two sons being adopted by Jacob, the lists don't always match up. And I think what you just said there about the reminder that in God's kingdom, the first are last, the last are first, that even as, you know, we focus on, say, Judah being the one through whom the Christ comes, and Joseph receiving all of this, you know, length in terms of blessing, they are all sons of Israel, and as sons of Israel, they are blessed through the God who makes his promises to his people, regardless of how much is spoken to them or in what order those words are spoken.
Right.
Good. All right, so we're going to start with Reuben, who is the firstborn of Jacob. This is verses 3 and 4 of the chapter. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the firstfruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Right, those are the words that Jacob speaks to Reuben. Verse 3 is very positive. Verse 4, not so much. What's going on here with Reuben?
Yeah, so it's, you know, you imagine placing yourself in Reuben's shoes. He hears the beginning of this, you know, verse 3. He's thinking, great, you know, Dad's forgotten about everything in the past. And then verse 4 is like, nope. Nope, it's coming back to get me. So this is one of those places where you see the effect of sin, you know, that it follows you sometimes. And this is one of those places. So what Jake Jacob, Israel is referring to in verse 4, and obviously this one's very specific. It's referring to an event from Genesis 35 where Reuben goes and commits sexual immorality with Bilhah, his concubine. And in that account, it's, you know, there's not a lot of commentary given. It's almost as if Jacob, you know, recognizes it, he hears about this, but then, you know, moves on. But obviously it's something that Jacob hasn't forgotten about. It's not just a case of sexual immorality, though, and that's where this can kind of trip us up some, because doing what Reuben did to his father in that way, it's not only just a huge slap in the face, it's an action that's symbolic, saying, I'm going to take what is my father's for myself. We see a similar thing that happens with King David and his son Absalom, who does something very similarly in the sight of all Israel. And he did that again for that purpose of usurping his father's authority. And that's what Reuben was attempting to do, which, you know, is sad and ironic in the sense that he was the firstborn. So had he not done that, you know, right, even barring the fact that Joseph was the favored child, you know, you would expect the firstborn is going to receive the lion's share of the inheritance anyways. But instead of receiving that as a gift, he tried to take it for himself to his downfall, which, again, is a helpful warning and reminder to us, because God offers us freely so many blessings, and oftentimes we try to take them for ourselves instead of simply receiving them. And anytime we turn that on its head and try to take what God is, you know, freely offering, that's when you can bet sin's going to come in and we're going to fall.
Yeah, I think, I mean, thinking about Jacob's perspective here, you can imagine the sorrow with which he speaks these verses. On the one hand, verse 3 sounds like the joy of a brand new parent who's just had his firstborn son. Here he is. And then verse 4 is that sorrow over watching what his son has done needlessly, even at the point that at the end of verse 4, you know, it's he went up to my couch, almost pointing it out to the rest of his sons. Look what he has done, rather than speaking to Reuben at that point. So it's a rather sorrowful start to the series of blessings, and yet does prove to be true. It's probably worth noting at this point, which you have mentioned already, that in the previous chapter, Jacob has blessed Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, two sons. Normally the firstborn would get the double portion. So we've kind of, if you just kind of keep, ignore the chapter break for a moment, see that the double portion is already gone to a different son, not to this one, not to Reuben.
Right. And without that chapter break, the other thing that comes in mind or comes out pretty clearly is the idea that Reuben's the firstborn. He should be the first of the sons to receive a blessing. And it appears he does if you just read 49 by itself. But when you look at chapter 48 ahead of it, you realize, oh, wait, Jacob's blessed, you know, his two grandsons even before he blesses his own sons. And so he's already upended that, you know, birth order blessing in how he's doing this.
Right, right. And so what Jacob says here to Reuben does prove true according to the Lord's word, that although he should have had, Reuben should have had this preeminence, in fact, he doesn't have preeminence within the land of Israel.
No, and so when you look at Reuben in the future and pair out, you know, what do we hear of Reuben? Who are the, you know, the men from the clan of Reuben or the women from the clan of Reuben that we hear of? There will be no prophet from Reuben. There's going to be no judge during the time of judges. No king will come from Reuben's line. And so this winds up being prophetic as to what's going to happen in the future.
Mm, yeah. So, okay, there is the section on Reuben. Now we already encounter a bit of an oddity with the next section, because now Jacob speaks to two sons at once rather than just one. So verses 5 to 7 are addressed to Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's verses 5 to 7. So Simeon and Levi are brothers, it is true, and full brothers at that. These are, the next two sons that Jacob has, both by Leah. But I think when he calls them brothers here, he's not talking about biology as much as he's, again, referring to something we've read about in Genesis previously.
Yeah, so he's calling them brothers, but really it's more their brothers in their personality, in their actions. And the fact that they're grouped together, it is an oddity, but the fact that they're grouped together is also a clue as to why Jacob is saying the things about them that he's saying. Because again, you're reading through this looking for blessings. And again, we're like, sheesh, at the end of this, he's going to divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Right. Like, man, this is coming off pretty harsh for his sons. But hear this too. This is a callback. He's in essence, he's judging them for things that had happened in the past. And so this is a callback to the events of Genesis chapter 34, really 25 through 30, where what happens, this is the aftermath of the rape of their sister Dinah. And if you remember that story, what happens, there's some back and forth after that rape has occurred. Dinah is eventually given to, I forget the prince's name, but there's a caveat that they should all the men of Shechem should be circumcised. And they agree to it. They're all circumcised. And while they're still recovering, that's when Levi and Simeon attack and they slaughter all the men of Shechem. Jacob hears about it. Again, this is one of those moments where there's not a whole lot that Jacob says in punishment of his sons, although he does recognize that this is going to be a stench in the nostrils of all of the people of the land. They're going to hear about this. But this is what Jacob is referring to when he's talking about their anger and all of the things. He's referring back to this moment. And one of the things it stands out to me, obviously, there's something God is saying to us here about our own propensity for anger and violence, that we have to keep that in check. But there's a line at the end of the chapter here in chapter 34, where, you know, Levi and Simeon, they talk back to their father and like, well, you know, we were just protecting our sister's honor and reputation. Shouldn't we have done that? And I think sometimes we make the same mistake. When we're angry and we feel justified in our anger, we tell ourselves, well, this is, you know, righteous anger. I should respond in the way that I do. But when you look at the scriptures as a whole, there's, you know, anger is always something that we're warned against. And Dr. Gibbs from the seminary wrote a great piece called The Myth of Righteous Anger, which if you haven't read it before, you can Google it. It's The Myth of Righteous Anger by Dr. Jeff Gibbs, and you'll pull it up. It's a long document. But he goes through the entirety of the scriptures in a really great way. I think it's about 30 pages long. And he kind of unpacks this idea that there is righteous anger on our part. And it's a good reminder that, you know, in our anger, we have to be really careful because anger is caustic. It's one of the ways which Satan attacks us because we think that we're justified in it. And yet often we're going to follow that to our own ruin, just as Levi and Simeon did here.
So, and the other thing that stands out in the words to Simeon and Levi as a result then of this anger that was expressed in the violence toward the Shechemites back in chapter 34, there's a bit of a prophecy, as you noted, it doesn't sound like a blessing, but it is a prophecy.
Right.
I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel, spoken to two sons and seems to prove true for both sons.
Yeah, so it does wind up being prophetic of both sons, but in different ways, which is what is particularly interesting. So for Simeon, this really does become a curse in the sense that it's prophetic about in just the way we expect it to be. It's negative. So he, you know, when you look at the beginning of the wilderness wanderings, there's a census taken, and Simeon is the third largest of the tribes numerically at that point. But just after 35 years of those wilderness wanderings, 65% of them had died, and they wind up becoming the smallest of the tribes of Israel. And so we see this idea that they're scattered among the tribes of Israel. This is what that is referring to. Now, in the case of Levi, this is one of the more interesting things that I discovered as I was kind of digging into this. It really winds up becoming a blessing for Levi. And in an odd way, because Levi, remember when the Israel goes into the promised land and they receive their allotments of land, Levi doesn't receive any. He receives some cities and surrounding fields for the provision, but no specific land. And the reason for this is because they become the clan of priests. And all of that points back to the events that had happened in Exodus chapter 32, the incident of the golden calf. So in that aftermath, you know, Moses comes down from the mountain, sees what's going on. He's understandably upset about what they're doing and how quickly they've turned away from the God of Israel who saved them. And he calls together, you know, anyone who's on my side is kind of the wording that he uses, come to me. And it's all the sons of Levi that gather to his side. And so it's because of that then that the scriptures talk about Levi not receiving an inheritance in the land because the Lord himself is their inheritance, which is an incredible blessing. Yeah. And while so it's interesting, this prophetic word of Jacob at the end here, I'll divide them in Jacob, scatter them in Israel. In the case of one son, it's a negative thing. In the case of another son, it winds up being prophetically positive.
Yeah, that's a pretty wonderful thing to note. We will look at the other 9 sons of Jacob on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor James Uglum this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org. LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Tuesday, April 21st. We're studying Genesis chapter 49, verses 1 to 27 with Pastor James Uglum. He serves at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in St. Peter's, Missouri. Pastor, prior to the break, we had looked at the first 3 sons of Jacob, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, none of which, Jacob says to them, sound too much like blessing, but certainly prophecy about what will come to the sons and their descendants in the future. The section on Judah, as we've already noted, is one of the longer ones in this section and has a place of prominence because, as we know, it is through Judah that the Christ will come. So here is what Jacob says to his son Judah, beginning in verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. That's through verse 12 of chapter 49. A lot of different images here, Pastor. And again, we could spend the entire time talking about these various images. But I think in connection to what we've read thus far, the much more positive images in their variety, words that refer to ruler, to might, take us into this section.
Yeah, so finally we get to a son for whom Jacob's got something really positive to say. Judah himself, you know, when you look back at his history and his past, he's far from a perfect man. There's the incident with his daughter-in-law, Tamar, and everything that goes along with that in Genesis 38. You do have Judah being the one that suggests selling Joseph into slavery, which is winds up actually happening, which is both positive and negative. It's negative in the sense like that wasn't the greatest outcome. However, it's far better than his brothers who were looking to kill him before that. So, you know, he at least of his brothers was at least in some small way looking out for Joseph. But, and this is the big kind of turning point, I believe, for Judah, which is when the whole subterfuge with Joseph is happening in Egypt and his brothers first come and Joseph recognizes them. And then there's that whole back and forth where, you know, he sends them back, but hides some cups and tries to keep Benjamin back and all of this. It's Judah who offers himself to stand in place of Benjamin, you know, recognizing that his own life might be forfeit because at that point they don't know it's actually Joseph they're speaking to. And so I can't help but think that, you know, obviously the story's come out now in terms of, you know, Jacob's heard all of this and heard how, you know, Judah was the one who was willing to stand in place of Benjamin in that way. It's also a reminder of these great words from Jesus, you know, greater love has no one than this, than that they lay down their life for their friend. And so that's, I think all of that kind of comes into play here. But then of course, prophetically, what we've got is this idea, you know, Judah is a lion's cub. We're looking ahead to Christ here in this passage in a very, I'd say very clear way, but incredibly powerful way with the images that we're given. That lion's cub is that imagery itself is picked up in Revelation. So it's Revelation 5, verse 5, where Jesus is called explicitly the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Obviously, that language is picked up through David and his descendants as well. But those are the things that we're seeing here. It winds up being 640 years after this prophecy is made before King David comes on the scene, and then another 1600 years of, you know, before this is fully realized in Christ. And this also then becomes one of the earliest prophecies of Christ itself. And it follows the pattern we've seen in Genesis where God starts off generally speaking of how he's going to restore his people and becomes, you know, more and more specific as time moves on. And so now, you know, it's not just that promise of the seed of Eve, the offspring of Eve in Genesis 3:15. Now we've got, you know, we're zeroing in on one tribe who's going to, you know, it's the scepter is never going to depart from them. So that's the stuff that we've got to look at here.
Sure. Yeah. And again, without going down every single rabbit trail we could follow, the image of the lion being picked up in the book of Revelation is a very significant one. The idea of the scepter and the staff belonging to Judah are picked up in a number of places. Psalm 2, the rod of iron that the son has. I mean, that seems to fit here. You know, this is obviously airing later in April during the season of Easter. We're recording it during Holy Week. And so you hear about the foal and the donkey's colt, and you can't help but picture what Zechariah preaches later, and then of course how Jesus fulfills it on Palm Sunday. And you've got the garments washed in wine and the blood of grapes. And you think of, was it Isaiah 63, I think, where he's treading the wine press. And that's even connected to the Lord himself. So, you know, while all these images, as you noted with the, you know, the prophecy of Genesis 3:15, and we see it now on this side of Christ's birth, death, resurrection, ascension, and we're like, oh, that's clearly about Christ. At this time, and same with this part of Genesis 49, right? The Lord is revealing these things over the course of history. And you know, is it a promise that the people held on to, the faithful of Israel? Absolutely. But they saw this as a shadow still. We've seen the substance now in Christ. And again, that's where you could just take this and run in any number of directions throughout the rest of the scriptures.
Yeah, its imagery here is just phenomenal. And obviously with Judah, as you mentioned earlier, just like with the disciples, we've got more information on some of the disciples and less on others. Same thing here with the tribes and the sons. Judah, of course, we know quite a bit more of because he winds up featuring so prominently as this prophecy points ahead, even though it's going to be the tribe of Benjamin through whom the first ruler comes, it's going to be the tribe of Judah through whom David comes, and it's to David God gives that incredible promise that you will always have a descendant on the throne. And that, again, points forward to Christ, who will be that son of David who sits on the throne of God forever. And we see that completed as, you know, as we're walking through the story of Christ here now in you know, in Holy Week and looking ahead to the season of the Easter, you know, when Jesus ascends, he ascends and is now seated on the throne of God at the right hand of God. And so it's all of this great imagery that is pointed to in this, probably arguably the most important of the blessings that Jacob gives his son, even though it's eclipsed briefly in terms of the word count by Joseph, his favorite son.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. That's right. The only other thing I want to draw our attention back to is, you know, as you noted, what we've heard about Judah thus far in Genesis and on both good and bad, I do think that that is, on the one hand, we see why, from a human perspective, Judah receives this blessing, and we see why Reuben, Simeon, and Levi have been disqualified. Yet at the same time, knowing the rather sordid details of some of the things that Judah has done, it is a reminder that the promise goes through Judah for the same reason that it goes through anyone, and it's by God's grace. Right? Judah is the one who carries on the line of the Christ by God's grace, the same as Jacob and Isaac and Abraham before him.
Exactly, and that's one of the incredible things that you get with genealogies in particular. So when you look at the genealogies of Jesus in Matthew and Luke, again, it's easy to breeze past those and read them quickly because it's just lists of names, but it's helpful to slow down sometimes and think and consider who those people are that are included in the genealogy. And it's a reminder that when you look at their stories, both the good and the bad, and realize, you know, God, even though, you know, they sin sometimes in spectacular ways, God used them in incredible ways by his grace, and it's through them and their work and their lives that the Christ himself eventually came.
All right, so we now get to much shorter sections in this chapter of Jacob's blessings, or maybe his testament. You know, last will and testament is maybe another way to consider this chapter. So next comes Zebulun, which is still the son of Leah, but we've flip-flopped the order here. Issachar, as well here, was actually born before Zebulun, but we're still with the sons of Leah. So Zebulun is verse 13. Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Not as much here. What can we draw from this verse?
No, there's definitely not as much here. We've got, obviously, the skipping of the birth order, which is significant. Obviously, Jacob is keeping all of Leah's children together as he's pronouncing his blessings on them. But Zebulun, you know, this is, if you were to list the, you know, these blessings, you know, by son as negative or positive, Zebulun, you know, at least appears neutral, you know, ish. It's definitely not negative. What it points forward to is their allotment in the land of Canaan. They wind up actually being sandwiched between the Mediterranean Sea on the one hand and the Sea of Galilee on the other. So they can look both ways in that sense, east and west, and see the sea. So it speaks to where they would wind up. But in terms of other things that we see in the story of Zebulun at the time of David, he's one of the clans, tribes that is faithful to David, winds up supplying the largest number of soldiers to his army, according to 1 Chronicles. Again, those are kind of obscure facts, but it does point to things to come for Zebulun, and, you know, how not only he himself, but how his descendants behaved and interacted together.
Yeah, that's right. The only other thing that I would add to that is the mention of the sea with Zebulun. If that sounds at all familiar, it might be from the passage in Isaiah 9, where it is the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, which is the way by the sea, and that land was shrouded in darkness, but it's there that the light dawns. St. Matthew quotes that in Matthew chapter 4, when Jesus begins his ministry, that is fulfilled. So there's one more connection you might find with Zebulun and the sea that maybe is a little more familiar than some of the references from Chronicles.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. So next comes Issachar. This is the, again, although he's the fifth son of Leah, he's the last son of Leah mentioned here. So verses 14 and 15. Issachar is a strong donkey, crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant. So he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Now, what are we hearing there about Issachar?
Yeah. So Issachar, he winds up becoming a large tribe, according to the census in Numbers 26. He's the third largest tribe, so obviously he supplants, Simeon before him in terms of prominence. this language, you know, becoming, where's this servant of forced labor? He bowed his shoulder to bear, became a servant of forced labor. This is where, you know, there's a little less clarity, but some would say, well, because of their size and abundance, you know, they became special targets of oppression. Foreign armies wind up being placed in servitude. You know, it's thinking maybe that's why Jacob, as he's giving the blessings of his son, switches the birth order here between Isaac and Zebulun again. But this one's a tough one in terms of looking at it and saying, well, why, you know, why is he saying what he's saying here?
Sure. So, yeah, there's just not as, yeah, this Issachar is one that we just know a little bit less about. But overall, I'd say, I mean, other than the forced labor part, relatively positive. We see the right. focus on geography still here with Issachar, much like Zebulun. Next comes Dan. And now we enter into the sons by the two maidservants. So Dan versus, I'm going to read verses 16 through 18, although 18 probably is its own thing. So Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Talk first about what is said to Dan.
Yeah, so Dan, when he says, you know, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel, looking ahead at things to come and looking at this as prophetic, it's through Dan that Samson comes, one of the more well-known of the judges of Israel. You know, he gets an extensive treatment. This serpent, by the way, bit, you know, a viper by the path that bites at the horse's heels so his rider falls backwards. Again, looking at that as being prophetic, if you connect that with Samson himself, you know, it could just be pointing to the fact that, you know, Samson is a judge of Israel, but, you know, as a Sunday school student, you know, we hear the story of Samson, we focus on his great strength, you know, God gave him all this, obviously, the luscious locks, for those of you who obviously are not seeing me, I have no hair, so I've always been a little jealous of him in that regard. However, Samson is not a great guy. He doesn't have a lot that great that happens to him. He reconnects with God only at the very end of his life, and in that moment, he winds up killing himself, and it's in his death that he kills more Philistines than he did in his life in terms of his judge of Israel. And so you get a little bit of that in this imagery of a serpent, by the way, biting at a horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. Again, it's prophecy, it's poetic, so make those connections at your own peril. But it is an interesting thing when you look at Samson, the most famous judge of Dan, or famous judge of Israel from Dan.
Well, and the other thing with the birth of Dan being, you know, Rachel saying, you know, I've been justified, vindicated, that connection with judging, vindication with Dan all makes sense. And I think Samson makes good sense as well. Now, verse 18 that doesn't really seem to go with any of the sons, but rather seems almost just a mid-testament prayer. And what's significant about, well, I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Now, one thing to notice is that we have the divine name Yahweh in this verse. And although, obviously, we've been hearing about the work of God all along, it's been quite some time in the book of Genesis since we've actually seen the name Yahweh, not since chapter 39, when we were first seeing Joseph begin his time in prison, and the Lord Yahweh was with him there. We haven't heard the name in a while. It's, I think, a significant thing that it shows up here in the midst of Jacob's last will and testament.
Yeah, for sure. It's when you read verse 18, it does stand out as kind of an interlude, even though it's connected with Dan and probably most of the, you know, translations that you happen to be reading. It's almost as if in the midst of his blessings, he pauses here and, you know, interjects, you know, I wait for your salvation, O Lord. You know, I believe in this point, you know, he's looking ahead to Christ, he's looking ahead to God working in this incredible way in the midst of all of the things that are, you know, that he's prophesying that are about to come.
Yeah, yeah. What a marvelous thing that Jacob, in the midst of this, focuses his own attention and the attention of his sons on the coming salvation that the Lord promises. So don't skip over that verse. It is important in the midst of all this. So I knew this was going to happen, Pastor Uglum. Well, I didn't. I hoped it wouldn't, but we're running shorter on
right.
time. So I'm going to actually read the next three sons together, each one who only has one verse, Gad, Asher, Naphtali. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Again, three short words, three tribes of which we know less from the Old Testament. What do we gain from these three verses?
Yeah, so with Gad, it seems to be, you know, a bit of a play on words that's going on here, because raiders shall raid Gad. Gad sounds like the Hebrew for both, you know, raids and raiders. So there's a little bit of that going on there. Not much more to say about that. In the same way with Asher, you know, obviously he's got a very positive blessing. His foods shall be rich, and shall yield royal delicacies. It appears to be pointing ahead prophetically to the allotment of land that he would receive in Canaan, which was especially rich in blessings and abundance and delicacies, you know, wheat, olive oil, milk, and butter. Not much more to say about that either. Naphtali is an interesting one. It connects back to Zebulun in that Matthew 4 passage you mentioned, because that phrase, where is this, that he, you know, that bears beautiful fawns can also be, you know, he gives beautiful words. And if you read it in that light, then it's especially poignant in the sense of, with Matthew 4, that Jesus spends so much of his time in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, where he speaks and teaches. And so that's a really great connection to Christ here in this passage as well.
Good, good. All right. The last two sons of Jacob are the sons from Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. I'm going to go ahead and read them together. Joseph has the largest section, however. This is beginning out verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. His archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father, who will help you? By the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, in the morning devouring the prey, and at evening dividing the spoil. And that brings us to the end of the text for today. So again, the majority there is about Joseph. Take us into that section. We've got about 6 minutes or so here.
Okay. Well, with Joseph, obviously, you can, if you hadn't read the accounts preceding this in Genesis, you could probably pick out the favorite son.
That's right.
Judah receives high praise, obviously, but Joseph, you could say, even higher praise from his father. You know, you can see the love that he has for Joseph, you know, come out here in a very poetic way, very beautiful way. But beyond that, you know, obviously there's a lot of great connections. One of the interesting things that stands out is this in verse 23, where he says, the archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely, yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile. Before we get into these, you know, great names of God, titles of God that Jacob lists here, it's a reminder of the history of Joseph and what's gone on before, that, you know, he led a very difficult life in many ways because of his own actions. I mean, he was a difficult brother to love when he was little, and that led to all of the stuff that befell him. But as you'll see as we close out the book of Genesis, at the end of his life, Joseph recognizes that even in his worst moments, God was there with him. God was working behind the scenes in ways that he couldn't imagine. And so this is a reminder that Joseph endured a lot in his life, but he remained faithful to God through it and recognized God's hand at work in his life. And for us, when you find those moments where it seems like your life is falling apart, where you wonder where God is, Joseph is a great guy to look back to and recognize he spent years in prison, years probably where there were times he wondered where God was. And yet, as he looked back on his life, he could see the hand of God at work in it. And I've seen that in my own life. You know, hopefully all of our listeners have seen that as well, that God does bring us through those. He doesn't promise us an easy life, prosperity all the time, but he does promise his presence with us. So it's something just to keep in mind. And then you get these great titles of God that Jacob lists. So he says he's the mighty God of Jacob. He's the shepherd, the stone of Israel, the God of your father, the Almighty. Obviously, the shepherd, the stone of Israel, we've got great connections to Christ, who calls himself the good shepherd, the stone of Israel, Jesus himself becoming the cornerstone that the builders rejected. But in terms of Jacob's own life, when he calls him the mighty God of Jacob, you know, you compare this to Genesis 31 earlier in his life when he referred to God as the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac. You know, you could see the maturity that he's gone through in his own life as well, where, you know, now he's claiming him as his own God as well. He's not just the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, but now he becomes the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.
Yeah, yeah. That's a reminder of the maturity of Jacob's faith, the way that we've seen that grow throughout his narrative. It's easy to lose sight of Jacob in the midst of all the story of Joseph, but that is right. A big part of what's happening here as well. Benjamin, then, the last son of Jacob, receives one verse, and he's described as a ravenous wolf who devours the prey both morning and evening. He's a pretty fierce guy.
Yeah. This is, again, one of those that it's helpful to look ahead and say, well, what do we know about the descendants of the tribe of Benjamin? You know, where do we see them pop up in the story of Scripture? There are a few places. The three probably most prominent are in the book of Judges. We get Ehud. It's a really great story where he sneaks in, kills the really fat king, loses his sword, and then runs away. You've got the story of Saul himself, who becomes Israel's first king. You know, and that is a incredibly hilarious story when you read it. You know, God selects him, appoints him. He's, you know, the tall, dark, and handsome guy. He's a head taller than everybody else. And then you go, Israel goes to crown him king, and they can't find him. And where do they find him? Hiding among the baggage. You know, if anything should have been the, maybe we got this wrong and asking for a king moment, that was it. And then obviously Saul, because of his own pride, impatience, you know, he loses that blessing of God, and it, you know, the kingdom is taken from him and given to his servant David. And then Paul is another guy, obviously, with when we get into the New Testament, he was of the tribe of Benjamin. And he spent, obviously, the first portion of his life persecuting the church. But then God met him and really transformed him in an incredible way that the gospel does in all of us. Probably worth noting, too, Esther and Mordecai, also of the tribe of Benjamin. So those are some of the connections that pop out real quick as you think, you know, ahead, where do we see this tribe and his descendants play out?
Yeah. All right. So there you have the words of Jacob to his 12 sons, looking forward into the future, all pointing to Christ. With about a minute here, Pastor, help us to wrap things up with a wide variety of material here. How does this chapter of Genesis serve to point us to Christ?
So the most clear way this chapter of Genesis points us to Christ is in the blessings given to Judah, where we see the promise of the Lion of Judah, the scepter never departing from him. More broadly, obviously, it points us all to Christ as we see the prophecies becoming fulfilled. It's a reminder that what God promises, God doesn't forget, even when the promise is long in being fulfilled, as it was in the promise to Judah here, where we see hundreds and in some cases thousands of years before the prophecy coming to fruition, God is not slow in keeping his promises.
Yeah, yeah, Jacob's prayer, I wait for your salvation, O Lord. And the Lord did not disappoint. He brought his salvation at the appointed time.
Amen.
Pastor James Uglum serves at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in St. Peter's, Missouri. He's been helping us today to study Genesis 49, verses 1 to 27. Pastor, thanks for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this section of Genesis 49, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we finish chapter 49 and get into chapter 50 as we read about Jacob's death and burial. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to KFUO.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to KFUO.org/store.